Or, in more modern language, this gave to God for nothing. Hast thou made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that hath on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth thine hand now and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. And mark this point with care. Satan did not say that Job was not serving God, did he? He never questioned the fact that Job was serving God. What then is the real argument Satan put forth? Satan put forth this argument. Look, he said, you have so blinded the eyes of Job by showering all these blessings upon him that he has not seen your real character. He hasn't seen your real character. But, and Luther went on to say in effect, look at me. For tens of thousands of years, as I imagine Luther must have lived before the fall, he said to God, I gave to you unstinted, unqualified, unquestioning service because I had not come to the place where I saw the real person that you were. And likewise, Satan said, Job has not seen the real God that I have come to see. And he can't see God, he can't see you as you are, because you shout all these blessings upon him and therefore literally bribed him into a position of servitude and the like. But Satan said, you just put forth your hand now and show yourself to be the oppressor that you are. And then see what Job will do. He'll wake up as I woke up. He'll rebel as I have rebelled. And he will curse thee to thy face. You see Satan's argument there as he met with God over the question of Job. And he is but repeating what he'd done up there in the kingdom of heaven. Now so it was then, as we read to you from the book Great Controversy, remember the sentence again, where he says that God was not just in laying laws and rules upon the inhabitants of heaven, but in requiring submission and obedience from his creatures, God was seeking merely the exaltation of whom? Himself. And, of course, his favorite son, Jesus Christ. Now, burdened with a great sense of mission, Luther went forth with a troubled expression upon his face, which at once raised the question in the minds of the angels. That, of course, is the very first effort that these murmurers and insinuators will always do. They raise questions and put doubts into the minds of these various creatures. Now, Luther did not go out and say he was offended because he hadn't been given a higher position. He went out and he expressed a great and a terrible concern. He said to the angels, think of it. All these years, these millenniums, I have been faithfully serving God, thinking and believing that God is just and true and honest and fair, just as you have been regarding the God of heaven. But, he said, I come from the very presence of God. I've caught a glimpse into what's going on up there in that high and holy place, and I have to tell you that what I see there fills me with the gravest of concern for the happiness and prosperity of this kingdom. And Luther would then make it appear that the only thing he wanted was to so revise the dealings of God, so remove these restrictions from the growth of his creatures, that heaven would become the place that it ought to be. And Luther made it appear that his whole mission now was devoted to this restoration or reconstruction of the government of God on fair and proper terms. Now, of course, he would confide to the angels, you know how powerful God is, and you know that it would have been much easier for me to have kept quiet about this and let all you folk go on being deceived, because I run the fearful risk of God coming down and saying to me, now look, Lucifer, I'm not going to tolerate someone coming out of the inner secrets of my throne and revealing these things to others. I'm going to punish you by either exile or banishment or destruction. And so Lucifer said to the angel, now, let's keep this thing secret. Let's not let God know what's going on because, well, he's not going to be too happy about my coming and telling you these things. And I take a fearful risk. I'm making tremendous sacrifice. In fact, I'm showing myself willing to sacrifice everything in order to promote the good of the universe. Now, can you see how craftily Lucifer worked to make it appear that he was the self-sacrificing one, that he was the noble one, that he was the good one, that he was the righteous one, and the God of heaven was the great deceiver, the bondage maker, the great dictator, the selfish one, the one who'd make no sacrifice at all for his creatures. And can you see too how effectively that argument could be presented in power to the creatures to whom Satan went? Now don't forget that Satan, or Lucifer, we should call him back at that time, was an angel who was revered and respected by every one of the other beings in the kingdom. After all, he led the heavenly choir. He was the brightest of the bright. He lived in the very presence of God. And the angels loved Lucifer with a deep and an enduring love, and they trusted him likewise. And Lucifer, of course, came out of the very, very presence of God himself. Now, you know, perhaps you know a family that you have had a great deal of esteem for, a family whom you've loved and respected, and of whom you thought only the very best. You never suspected them of anything underhand or wrong or the likes of it. You thought of that man as being a good husband and father, of the wife as being a good mother and so forth. And then one day there comes to you the eldest child of the family. And he doesn't come to you with anything that looks like a malicious spirit. He comes to you that he's burdened with a great burden. And you ask him what the trouble is. And he might not even be prepared to tell you at first. And then he'll tell you a little snippets and little things that cast a shadow upon his father's behavior. And he'll say to you, now, you don't really know my father. You see him in society when he's on his best behavior. I see him in the home. I see the way he treats my mother. I see the things he says and does in the home. And he presents to you a very, very different picture altogether. Now, can you find it in your mind to lightly dismiss the message of that boy? Why, of course not. Coming from where he does, and expressing things the way he expressed those things, carries a great deal of authority and conviction, doesn't it? And likewise, when Lucifer came in that kind of way, masterfully expressing his doubts and insinuations, then it raised in the minds of the angels a very real and a very certain question mark on the character of God. So much so that a great uneasiness settled down upon the kingdom of heaven, so much so that the angels were deceived as to the real character of God and the real intent and purpose of God in the kingdom. Now, if I ask you the question, I guess now that you possibly read it in the Messenger, how many of the angels are deceived by Satan's sophistry? One-third? Well, now, true, one-third, as Revelation 12 points out, were completely deceived by Satan to the point where they threw in their lot with him and backed up his revolution. Because, of course, that is what it amounted to. But in actual fact, all three-thirds of the angels were deceived, at least in part, by Satan's sophistry. And that's proved by simply reading the statement from Desire of Ages, page 761 in the Standard Edition, and two or three pages at the beginning of the chapter in the chapter it is finished in the book Great Controversy. I read here, to the angels and the unfallen worlds, the cry, "It is finished," had a deep significance. It was for them, as well as for us, that the great work of redemption had been accomplished. They, with us, share the fruits of Christ's victory. Not until the death of Christ was the character of Satan clearly revealed to the angels or to the unfallen worlds. The arch-apostate has so clothed himself with deception that even holy beings have not understood his principles. They had not clearly seen the nature of his rebellion. Paragraph 2 and 3 of the chapter, it is finished. Not page 761 yet. Paragraph 2 and 3, good, of the chapter. And note the wording in this particular paragraph before we go across to page 761. Notice that the cry, "It is finished," had a deep significance for whom? The angels and the unfallen world. It was for them, as well as for us, that the great work of redemption had been accomplished. They, with us, share the fruits of Christ's victory. Not until the death of Christ was the character of Satan clearly revealed to the angels or to the unfallen worlds. And this means then, doesn't it, that between the beginning of the Great Rebellion, right down to the cross of Calvary, the character of Satan was something which the angels of God could not clearly see. And if they could not clearly see his character, then how did that character appear to them, in a good light or a bad light? At least in part in a good light. Now come across to, well, let's read the rest of the paragraph again. The archapostate had so clothed himself with deception that even holy beings had not understood his principles. They had not clearly seen the nature of his rebellion. I come across to page 761, where we find that this thought is developed a little further. A bit hard to find in this, here it is. Satan saw that his disguise was torn away. His administration was laid open before the unfallen angels and before the heavenly universe. He had revealed himself as a murderer. By shedding the blood of the Son of God, he had uprooted himself from the sympathies of the heavenly being. Henceforth, his work was restricted. Whatever attitude he might assume, he could no longer await the angels as they came from the heavenly courts and before them accused Christ's brethren of being clothed with the garments of blackness and of the defilement of sin. The last link of sympathy between Satan and the heavenly world was broken. When? At the cross of Calvary. Now bear in mind, there's a vast difference between having sympathy for a person in a sad predicament and having sympathy with a person in their purposes and aims. Now, let's be honest about it. Can't you feel sorry for Satan? I mean, sorry for him in the predicament in which he finds himself today? Would you like to be in his shoes and go on to face the great fire of final destruction? Would you like to have rolled upon you the sins of all the people of all the righteous that Satan has caused them to commit in the last days? Why, certainly not. Would you like to be deprived forever of the glory of the kingdom of heaven? Well, of course you wouldn't. And I can feel desperately sorry for him in the position he finds himself in. But that's one thing. But I want to come to that place where, in the truest sense of the word, I have absolutely no sympathy at all between him and me, so far as his plans, his thinking, his aims, and his objectives are concerned. Now, I believe this, that today, even though we have been delivered of the carnal nature, that just insofar as we still retain any habits of the old way of life, to that extent, we are still in sympathy with Satan and his work. Just as the angels of heaven, right from the fall of Lucifer to the cross of Calvary, still retained a link of sympathy between Satan and themselves, because they felt that, after all, maybe there was something that Satan had seen that wasn't yet cleared up so far as their minds were concerned. Now, we have to appreciate, well, we can't appreciate, I'm sure, the really masterful power of the deceptions of Lucifer. Let me read this statement from the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, the Ellen G. White comments on John chapter 3, 16. John chapter 3 and verse 16. From page 1133 of volume 5 of the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary. The head of the first column, Light from the Cross. Now, beg your pardon, it's page 1132, my mistake. The head of the second column. The death of Christ upon the cross made sure the destruction of him who has the power of death, who was the originator of sin. When Satan is destroyed, there will be none to tempt to evil. The atonement will never need to be repeated, and there will be no danger of another rebellion in the universe of God. That which alone can effectually restrain from sin in this world of darkness will prevent sin in heaven. The significance of the death of Christ will be seen by saints and angels. Fallen men could not have a home in the paradise of God without the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Shall we not then exalt the cross of Christ? Now listen to what follows. The angels ascribe honor and glory to Christ, for even they are not secure except by looking to the sufferings of the Son of God. It is through the efficacy of the cross that the angels of heaven are guarded from apostasy. Without the cross, they would be no more secure against evil than were the angels before the fall of Satan. angelic perfection found in heaven, human perfection found in Eden, the paradise of bliss, all who wish for security in earth or heaven must look to the Lamb of God. 1132, Volume 5 of the Seventh-day Adventist Bible Commentary, Ellen G. White comments. Now, this means then that when Lucifer began his work up there in the kingdom of heaven, that not one third of the angels, but all three thirds of the angels were deceived, at least to a certain extent. Not sufficiently, of course, was the majority to follow Lucifer in his work of rebellion. They remained with God, but they served him from the fall until the cross of Calvary with a question mark in their minds. Now, we can feel very sympathetic now toward God for this, because I know only too well what a cloud is passed over a movement such as this, over the Church of God, when there rises up within amongst us a Lucifer. We've had them in the past. We said a great deal about them last year. They left us now, of course. And when they rise up, they gain sympathy from a large number of people in the movement. Very often, because of our position and the added information we have and the wide experience which we have, we can see very plainly and clearly the real character of these men. But the believers in the movement find that there's raised a question in their minds, just as it was raised up there in the minds of the angels of heaven. And when that question is there, can there be perfect unity, perfect fellowship? Why, impossible. And so likewise, while that question was up there in heaven for 4,000 years, there could not be the most perfect unity in heaven that God designed and longed that there should be. Now mark this point with care. Back when Lucifer first rebelled, God did not need to have any personal revelation of the character of Lucifer, because God saw it all, and Christ saw it all, and they could from the very beginning understand the ultimate end of Lucifer's activities, his thinking, his plans, his claims, and the like. But the angels could not see it, the angels could not know it, and the one and only way in which they could come to know it was to allow this thing to come to its full fruition and come to the place where Satan had his deception torn away and the real Lucifer brought out into the open. Now therefore, and we read this of course in Great Controversy, page 498 as we go on, the discord which his own course had caused in heaven, Satan charged upon the law and government of God. Now, I used to wonder how ever Satan could make that charge stick. But if it was true that God's declaration of his justice in giving to each person the position which they merited, if that had proved to be a lie and a false claim on God's part, if God in actual fact had made laws which were a protection for Jesus Christ and a limitation to all the rest, then when that was discovered, there would have to be discord, question marks, and rebellion in the kingdom of heaven. And Lucifer would turn around and said to God, now if only you had been true and honest and had not made these laws to protect Jesus Christ, then of course we would have gone on giving you glad and happy allegiance. We wouldn't have been stirred and upset and indignant about this. But now we've discovered the real nature of your claims and character, and how can you blame the situation which has resulted because of that discovery? Now, I believe it's important for us to understand Lucifer's case back there and Lucifer's position to see how he could make those charges stick up there in the kingdom of heaven. I read on, all evil he declared to be the result of a divine administration. He claimed it was his own object to improve upon the statutes of Jehovah. Therefore, it was necessary that he should demonstrate the nature of his claims and show the working out of his proposed changes in the divine law. His own work must condemn him. Satan had claimed from the first that he was not in rebellion. The whole universe must see the deceiver unmasked. Now here comes a sentence now which I think we should always remember. It's my own words. It paraphrases what we read here in Great Controversy, of course. And that is this: that God permitted the great controversy to go on for 6,000 years to accomplish a certain purpose. And that purpose is to reveal to angels and the unfallen worlds and the fallen man, the real character of Satan on the one hand, and the real character of God on the other hand. Now that is the purpose of the great controversy. That's clear, isn't it? Very good. Now if that is the purpose of the great controversy, then the great controversy must go on and on and on until that great purpose has been achieved. If God should cut the great controversy short before the purpose is achieved, then why allow the great controversy in the first case? It'd be pointless, wouldn't it? Do we find God ever doing an incomplete work, a partial work, an unfinished work? Why, never. What God begins, what does he do? He finishes right through until the very end. So I read on, even when it was decided that he could no longer remain in heaven, infinite wisdom did not destroy Satan. Since the service of love can alone be acceptable to God, the allegiance of his creatures must rest upon a conviction of his justice and benevolence. The inhabitants of heaven and of other worlds, being unprepared to comprehend the nature or consequences of sin, could not then have seen the justice and mercy of God in the destruction of Satan. Had he been immediately blotted from existence, they would have served God from fear rather than from love. The influence of the great deceiver, the influence of the deceiver would not have been fully destroyed, nor would the spirit of rebellion have been utterly eradicated. Evil must be permitted to come to maturity. For the good of the entire universe through ceaseless ages, Satan must more fully develop his principles, that his charges against the divine government might be seen in their true light by all created beings, that the justice and mercy of God and the immutability of his law might forever be placed beyond all question. So let's have this clear in mind then, that the purpose of the great controversy is to clearly reveal to those who could not yet see it the nature of God on the one hand and the nature of Satan on the other hand. For while Lucifer thought he had discovered a great discrepancy in the character of God, while he thought he had discovered an ulterior motive, a self-serving motive, the facts are that that is not so. That God has not made laws to elevate Jesus Christ and limit the rest, that God has made laws of such fairness and justice and equity and equality as to give to everybody an equal right and an equal position in the kingdom of heaven. And that has to be seen and demonstrated and proved beyond any shadow or doubt or question. Now at the cross of Calvary, as we've just written the Desire of Ages, a tremendous gain was achieved by the death of Christ there on Calvary. That is, as we come down to Calvary's cross, the time came when righteousness appeared at its very best and sin appeared at its very worst. And the angels looking on from above and the unfallen worlds looking on from above saw with their own eyes the fullest possible revelation of the character of Satan on the one hand, and on the other hand the fullest possible revelation up till that time of the character of God. And of course, the wickedness of wickedness was made just that much more wicked as it stood in contrasting picture to the brightness and the glory and the righteousness of the God of heaven. Now, in other words, what God has been striving to do down to those 4,000 years from the creation here up until the death of Christ was to tear the mask away from Satan and to show him to be what he was. And during those 4,000 years, Satan was determined to keep that mask very much over himself so that everybody looking at him would see not the wolf within, but the sheep's clothing without. Now we'll study as we go on, of course. The only way, of course, whereby that mask can be taken away, it can't be taken away by force. It can only be taken away by the revelation of the living righteousness of God against which Satan goes to war. And he must extend himself and extend himself and extend himself until finally he exhausts every weapon in disguise and must come out in the open to bring his last weapons to bear. And then, of course, he is seen to be what he is. Remember very well a story which illustrates this principle that, and I like this too, because so many people today think they're going to correct the evils of the world by denouncing the evils in the world. Now, God could never have successfully won the war against Satan simply by denouncing him and stating in words what Satan was. Because while God said so and so, Satan had his countercharges. And pretty soon would have descended to the position where Lucifer was hurling bad names at God and God was hurling bad names back at Lucifer. And what would that have proved? Precisely nothing at all. Instead, God came down, instead of wasting his time hurling bad names at Lucifer, in Jesus Christ in fallen human nature, God lived out his own perfect righteousness. And if there's one thing which Satan hates and fears, of course, is the revelation of God's character. And so he went to work to destroy Jesus Christ, became more and more desperate in his efforts until finally he was forced to tear away his mask and show himself to be what he was, the murderer of the Son of God. And then he was seen for what he was. And likewise today, those reformers, so-called, who rise up to correct the world's evils by hurling bad names at the church and denouncing the church for doing this and that, the other thing, and the church in turn hurls bad names back at them, accomplish nothing. It soon descends into a bad name contest and nothing is gained. There was a time when, as this little fable goes, the sun and the wind had an argument as to which was the stronger. And the wind, of course, boldly claimed that he was much stronger than the wind. Why? He said, I can rush down there and tear up trees and blow buildings over, and you can shine all your life and you can't do that. Well, said the sun, let's put this to the test. And on this cold, wintry morning, there was a man walking along wearing an overcoat. And the sun said to the wind, take his coat off, and if you can't do it, I will. The sun went behind the cloud while the wind had its time to carry out the contest. The wind went down and blew fiercely and savagely and tried to tear the coat off that man. But the harder the wind blew, the more the man wrapped his coat around himself to protect himself from the wind. Until exhausted, the wind gave up, with the man still wearing that overcoat ever more tightly and securely than when the wind began. And then the smiling sun came out as the wind retired from the scene and beamed his warm rays down upon that man, until it became so warm he gladly took the overcoat off. Now, isn't there a message in that little story? It's a fable, sure, but it carries a message and shows to us that what appears to be the way of doing things, the forceful, direct way, the head-on collision way, is not God's way of doing things. God does things the opposite way. And the surest and quickest way to reveal unrighteousness and to bring out sin and evil is to show the contrasting picture of righteousness, because only where righteousness appears at its best can sin be made to appear at its worst. And that's worth remembering, isn't it? Only where righteousness appears at its best can sin be made to appear at its worst. And that's how it was back there upon the cross of Calvary. But here's the point now. Well, I may add too that some people say, well now, look at so-and-so, he fills a little magazine with all the wrongs of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and he spreads this around, and I just learned things about the Adventist Church I would never have known but for that little paper. Why, this man will say, he's about the only person sighing and crying for the abomination to be done on the land. And therefore that man's sure to get the seal of God, and he's sure to find himself in the kingdom of heaven. But along side by side with these denunciations of the Adventist Church, you'll find some rather weird doctrines. Doctrines that are the complete denial of the third angel's message. Doctrines which exalt the human being. Doctrines which find no part nor place in God's truth today. And when you meet the person, you find a hard, unchristian spirit which is not a reflection of the spirit of Jesus Christ. And then you're reminded of that man who back in old Jerusalem went up and down the walls for 7 years denouncing the sins of that city. Let me find you a statement here in the book Great Controversy, page 30, where it says, for 7 years, a man continued to go up and down the streets of Jerusalem, declaring the woes that were to come upon the city. By day and by night, he chanted the wild dirge, a voice from the east, a voice from the west, a voice from the four winds, a voice against Jerusalem and against the temple. A voice against the bridegroom and the brides. A voice against the whole people. The strange being was imprisoned and scourged, but no complaint escaped his lips. To insult and abuse, he answered only, "Woe, woe to Jerusalem! Woe, woe to the inhabitants thereof!" His warning cry ceased not until he was slain in the siege he had foretold. Now, wouldn't you think that man was a Christian? Crying and sighing for the abomination to be done in the land, no complaint escaping his lips, that he died with the fall of the city. The next sentence says, not one Christian perished in the destruction of Jerusalem. What's the inference? He wasn't a Christian, because he died in the destruction of the city, and not one Christian died in the overthrow of that great city. Now, in conclusion then, to this particular theme, there at the cross of Calvary, a gigantic advance step was made in the purpose of the great controversy. So far as angels and unfallen worlds were concerned, the purpose was fulfilled. They saw the character of Satan. They broke completely their link of sympathy with him, and for them the work was done. But had at that time the same revelation been made clear enough for man to see and understand? Not at all. Men upon this earth have not yet come to the place where they have seen the real character of Satan and universally have withdrawn their support from him. Is that day coming? Why, certainly it is. And our next study, a little later, we'll read from Great Controversy the thrilling picture of that great and terrible day when the wicked shall see that they have been deceived, and the ministry shall turn around and confess their work of deception. Now, when the people see that they have been deceived, they'll know who has deceived them. And who? Yes, the ministry. And, of course, back of it all, whom? Satan himself. Now, when they see that they have been deceived and Satan has been the deceiver, then how much weight do Satan's arguments have with them anymore? None whatsoever. So at that point of time, Satan's support is completely and absolutely lost so far as they're concerned. And when the ministers or his chief agents turn around and confess their work of deception, then likewise Satan loses his best agents, and in 1 minute of time, he comes to his end with none to help him. And Daniel 11 verse 45 is fulfilled in that great and dreadful day. Now when that time comes, the purpose of the great controversy will have been fulfilled, both for angels and for men. And when it is fulfilled, then what then will keep the King of Kings tarrying any longer? Nothing. His coming will then be immediate. But now here is the point. Satan, this side of the cross, is just as determined to maintain his mask of deception and keep the whole world under deception as he ever was before the cross of Calvary. And while he knows that he's lost the battle so far as the minds of the heavenly beings is concerned, he knows perfectly well he hasn't lost the battle yet so far as the mind of man is concerned. Therefore, God's task today remains still to tear the mask off this arch-deceiver. And how can he do it? Only by a display of righteousness at its very best. Now, Jesus Christ came down to this earth, back there, and gave that first display, and effectively tore the mask of Satan so far as the onlooking angels and the unfallen worlds were concerned. But he didn't succeed then in taking the work far enough to have the minds of men undeceived. No discredit to Christ, of course, because he'll win the battle in the end anyway, and he'll finish what he began back there at that time. But now here's my point. Is Jesus Christ going to come down in person and walk this earth again, and the second time reveal righteousness himself to the point where Satan is unmasked finally before the minds of men? Is he? No, he's not. He's already done that, but that revelation must still be made. And it must still be made and has to be made in fallen human nature, right? So therefore, other fallen human nature than that which was his own personal body must be that through which this revelation is to be made. And who will that people be? The 144,000. Now this begins to open to us something of the significance of the role of this people who shall walk in perfect righteousness upon the earth in the last days. This means that we, this generation, have before us the prospect of being the people through whom Christ shall so completely and perfectly live, that nothing short of righteousness at its very best will be revealed in human nature, to the point where sin shall be revealed at its very worst, and then the minds of men, as well as the minds of angels, shall see sin to be what it is on the one hand, and righteousness to be seen for what it is on the other hand. Now, I couldn't think of anything more solemn for us to meditate upon than this great and fearful responsibility which rests upon this people. The great harvest lays in the tomb waiting to be gathered. Because the dead have been judged, they have been sealed, and all that remains now is the voice of God to say to the sleeping saints, awake, your Father calls you. But they cannot come forth until the first fruits have been gathered, the 144,000, presented at the sanctuary and received of God and sealed, and then being sealed, give that revelation of perfect righteousness which will bring forth the very worst in Satan, to the point where men upon this earth will reject him completely. Now, the dead in their graves can do nothing for themselves. They're depending upon a generation upon this earth to reveal that righteousness. We can be that people. The very purpose of the message which God has brought to us at this time is to develop that people. But if we don't rise up, as generations in the past have failed to rise up, then we shall join the dead where they are and wait with them till another generation arises and does for the dead and for us what we might have done for them. The time has come when God is revealing to us the full nature of the role, the full nature and scope of the work, the implications of this work that the people of God are to perform and to fulfill in these last days. Now, 1 Peter said, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy conversation and righteousness? And as we proceed with this theme over the next few days, I trust that God will open our eyes to see what we ought to be and to rise to the occasion and be what we ought to be, that the work can be finished. The first fruits gathered in, and the great harvest of the ages gathered from their tombs and taken home to the heavenly kingdom. May God bless us to this end, is my prayer today.